not one, but two celebrations this week to honor the life and legacy of MLK. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, why Jacksonville is hosting dueling Martin Luther King breakfast this week for the second year in a row. Join our conversation. It's 549-2937. Then later, a new model of healthcare comes to town, plus local artist Jason Tetlack. But first this hour, Monday marks Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We'll see a major parade and other celebrations, and plenty of us will have the day off, too. Also, for the second year in a row, Jacksonville will have two major Martin Luther King Jr. breakfasts tomorrow. Local civil rights groups say it's because City Hall isn't on board with their vision of how to honor MLK. Charles Griggs of the 100 Black Men of Jacksonville and a board member contributor here at WJCT is here now with a closer look. Hey, Charles, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
What are your thoughts about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. and the competing breakfast that we're going to see again in Jacksonville this year? The number to join us, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. All right, so the 33rd annual MLK Breakfast, sponsored by the NAACP, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the African American Ministers Leadership Council, that's coming up Friday morning at the Hyatt. Nearby, the city is hosting its own MLK Breakfast at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. The first time this ever happened in modern times was last year. And this year we're seeing it again. Let's explain why.
Well, I think it's fair to us for us to give a little bit of history, Melissa, back to how all of this started. And when the breakfast started 33 years ago, it was really a negotiation between then Chamber President William Bond and his wife, Sandy Bond. They had traveled to another community and saw the MLK celebrations going on in that community. And they felt like that this would be a great idea to bring the Jacksonville community together to sort of really celebrate the legacy of MLK. Mr. Bond at the time came back and consulted with then President of the Jacksonville Urban League, Ronnie Ferguson. And Mr. Ferguson pulled in then President of NAACP, Ms. Willie Dennis. And they all discussed on how this thing would come together. And then the breakfast was born. It was a partnership between the chamber, the NAACP, and the Jacksonville Urban League. A few years later, the SCLC joined in on the discussion as well. Over time, the breakfast went, it was really sort of an event to celebrate, you know, how Jacksonville could come together in spite of all of the differences. Because at the time, in the late 80s, we did have significant differences as we do today. Around education, and especially minority contracting. There was a big divide around that time. And they felt like this was an opportunity to really sort of to get all the parties together and sort of be able to work together in pursuit of a better Jacksonville.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Last year, the president of the local NAACP, Isaiah Rumlin, said that his organization stopped seeing eye to eye with City Hall, that they had differences with the Lenny Curry administration about this event. And because they didn't feel they had enough input into the event, there was a rift that somehow got created. We are with two events. Why is this?
Well, so the disagreement occurred about 4 years ago when the NAACP and the Jacksonville Urban League and the other civil SELC were really used to working with the administration on how to plan and develop the breakfast. Certainly you can understand that the NAACP and civil rights organizations are fairly accustomed to having a more spiritual, more civil rights flavored, themed event. The administration obviously is more focused on having an event that looks more progressive and something that they can celebrate as they call something for the entire community. Because there's such a divide in how the civil rights organizations view local politics as well as progress in the community as it relates to race relations, you can see that come out in the discussions and how they decided to work together and therefore they weren't able to put together a breakfast.
So in other words, what I hear you saying is the city of Jacksonville isn't comfortable with the narrative that the civil rights groups will present on the stage. In that, from their point of view, this city and this country still has a long way to go in terms of racial equality. Is that accurate to say?
Yes, certainly. I've spent some time interviewing Mr. Rumlin, Isaiah Rumlin, president of Jacksonville NAACP, on my podcast, and he expressed that now he believes that this is bigger than just a breakfast, yes, and that the circumstances around why they are not able to come to an agreement on how a breakfast should be celebrating the entire community, should be organized to celebrate an entire community, really is indicative of the challenges that we have as a community here in Jacksonville.
What do you mean by that? What, when you say challenges, specifically what?
Well, and not speaking for Mr. Rumlin, but certainly from what he said during the podcast, was that we have issues that they believe, the NAACP and other civil rights organizations believe, that they can certainly be helpful in providing meaningful solutions around crime, around economic development. They are certainly in support of the school board superintendent's referendum for the have-cent sales tax. And they believe that advocating for certain issues in the community has kept the conversation from happening in a civil way so that they can come together. And really, to be honest, Melissa, this was the very thing that that Mr. Ferguson, Ms. Dennis, and Mr. Bond were trying to organize the breakfast for, because they felt like even though people had differences, they were able to come together and celebrate the legacy of MLK, at least on one day, and then maybe perhaps be able to continue those conversations going forward so they could come to some common ground on some of those major issues.
It's 549-2937. How do you think the city should best honor the life and legacy of Martin Luther King Jr.? Well, this gives you an idea of the different tone of the two events. At the civil rights event at the Hyatt, Martin Luther King III, the son of MLK, will be the keynote speaker. At the city-sponsored event, entrepreneur Omar Johnson, formerly a marketing officer at Beats by Dre and former vice president of marketing at Apple.
Well, actually, speak. The city's event, is the speaker has now changed.
Oh, they've changed
Mr.
it.
Mr. Johnson was not available to make it due to some family issues. And so the new speaker is Coach Carter. Coach Ken Carter from the movie Coach Carter, so from Richmond High School in California. So he's going to be the speaker for the city's event on Friday morning.
How does this put people? How does this present to people who want to attend an event? They have to choose now for the second year in a row which event they should attend, and there are political considerations attached to which event you show up and attend.
So that is the big, sort of. Really crux of the problem here, because, people who I've talked to throughout the community, certainly stakeholders and citizens as well, believe that it is impractical to try to attend both events. So you're forced to sort of pick sides. A lot of folks who I've spoken with say that they plan on trying to attend both events, but can you imagine that people getting up from one event at one time, only to travel to the other event at another portion during, it is impractical. Mm-hmm. So the solution here is to either work together or have events at separate times.
It's unfortunate, given that the whole point of these annual events is to bring a city that might have had difficult racial episodes in the past together, to give a voice to the other side of the coin. A statement from City Hall says, look, there's room for more than one event. We're trying to be positive in this endeavor.
And I agree. I think there's room for more events. Martin Luther King's legacy certainly suggests that we should have as many celebrations as we'd like. I would agree that we should have two breakfasts times 10, but it's impractical to believe that you can have two significant events only because of the way that they were initially brought together. In the same space at the same time. When I say space, I mean time. You really have to take in consideration the public and their interest in sponsors, corporations, how they plan on attending these events. People have to make choices, and those choices are really sort of being forced along, for lack of a better term, in some cases, political lines. People are trying, some folks may want to show their allegiance to the civil rights organizations as they sit, and other folks may want to show their allegiance to the city as they, look to seek to celebrate the King holiday as well.
And how does this fall in the wake of the bombshell news that JEA, the aborted attempt to sell off JEA is now being investigated by federal prosecutors, and how that affects people's political calculus on a number of decisions they make, well, whether it's this event or something else.
Well, certainly the news around circling JEA is the talk of the town. Both in and out of political circles. Certainly it is not lost upon those civil rights organizations, given the fact that so much money is involved, let's put it this way, and that this the results of whatever comes out of this will have an impact on the entire community. People are watching, and allegiances, like you said, they are being drawn along those lines. Some people believe that because of the leadership at JEA, that this may have circumvented opportunity in the African American community, and this is one of the challenges that have to be addressed. It's difficult to tell, though, what real impact JEA's quandary will have on tomorrow's attendance, so to speak. But you can certainly know that there will be discussion, probably behind as this situations go on, and what people believe and what they think is going to happen in the end.
And what do you think, everybody? Call us up. It's 549-2937. Patrice is on the west side. Hi, Patrice. Go ahead.
Hi. I think that I'm glad that the NAACP isn't having a joint activity with the city. I don't agree with how the NAACP is. I don't think they're progressive enough, but I definitely don't think that the city of Jacksonville is currently representing the black community well. I think they overlook a lot of things that are currently affecting the black community. And so I am glad that the NAACP is not having an event such as, you know, that MLK breakfast with the city.
Okay, and Patrice, are you planning to attend an event?
I would like to, and if I did, I mean, no, I will not attend either one of them because I think it would make me a hypocrite.
Okay, well, thank you for that.
I want to.
Okay.
But I won't.
But you won't. Is that a concern that attendance is going to come down at either one or both of these events? In the past, you'd have everybody all in one room.
Yeah.
Now you're dividing it into two rooms.
Well, certainly last year there were two breakfasts, you mentioned. The one that the NAACP and the other civil rights organizations hosted was well attended. In fact, it was sold out, but it was in a smaller venue. This year they have a more comparable venue. It's at the Hyatt, so they expect, from what I've been told, they're going to be pretty much sold out if they haven't already done so. The cities, of course, they seem to maintain their attendance level at around 1,200 or so, and that's been consistent throughout the years, and I don't anticipate that it'll be any different this year. I hadn't heard anything to the contrary.
Has this happened in any other large city that you know of? Most mayors of cities want to be on the same page with the folks that are honoring MLK. This is kind of unusual.
It is very unusual, and I think that that's an excellent point. Usually in the communities I visit, when folks hear that there are two separate events going on at one time, they kind of shrug their shoulders and ask, why is that necessary, and how come, we can't be on the same page? But, it takes leadership in order to get past these types of issues, and you would expect that at some particular point, leaders can come together and put their differences aside and understand why it's important to have, certain voices heard in the community. And certainly the other side would have to understand, why it's important for them to have certain things done as well. What's important to mention, Melissa, is that when this event was born, in talking with Mr. Ronnie Ferguson, they really wanted to be inclusive of the entire community, and not just the African-American community. They really wanted to celebrate other ethnic groups in the community, especially Hispanics and the Asian community, and really embed that participation as one, one large, gigantic community. And because there's such a rift going on now, it is, all of that gets lost. And that is the unfortunate part. And we know that other communities are looking at us, and other people like the caller is concerned that we aren't going far enough in terms of the way civil rights organizations are really working and progressing in our community. And, you know, we can help each other with that. You know, that is not a one organization pull and tug. It is really incumbent upon the entire community to do a better job at representing everyone.
Troy is on the east side. Hello, Troy. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
All right. I wanted to say that, unfortunately, there's a lot of misgiving about the Dr. King holiday. And that particular holiday is the most disrespected federal holiday on the books. The average business in Jacksonville does not recognize Dr. King's holiday. And a lot of people who take off from on the King holiday might be fired if they do. That's Jacksonville in a nutshell.
Well, thanks for that. And, you know, thank you for that. Let's talk about Monday, because we're talking about the breakfasts on Friday, but the official holiday is Monday. There will be a parade downtown. You can come to that. It's always a lot of fun. But what about his comment that it's not a well-respected federal holiday?
Yeah, and I think that's many people in the African-American community feel that way, because this is a holiday that, if it's a federal holiday, but it's not necessarily a holiday that other, you know, state and local officials may be taking that at the same time, or private businesses, we should say, much like July 4th or what have you. So many people have to take the day off in order to celebrate the MLK holiday. And because, you know, like you mentioned, the parade is a fascinating, amazing event. It lasts for a long time. Everyone comes out, and it's very long, but it's a lot of fun. And people look forward to it, because this is a one time a year that you sort of celebrate that unity. And you like to see the entire community come out and celebrate the MLK holiday because of the legacy of Dr. King. And to the caller's point, we don't really see the entire community doing that. What we normally get is that this is more of a black holiday than something that the entire community should celebrate.
That's unfortunate, because the whole idea behind it is to bring an entire city together. And let's go to Keith in Riverside. Hi, Keith. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment that what you're seeing now is the same divisions that Martin Luther King faced in his day. He had begun to become much more militant, because he saw the hypocrisy in both the religious community and the government. And he was beginning to think that America wasn't going to change. And we're facing the same thing now. The white community seems to want to highlight how he was, you know, nonviolent and said, you know, turn the other cheek and, you know, just persevere, et cetera. And the black community was saying, we still have the same problems that we had then. So essentially, white people have essentially tried to hijack Martin Luther King and just take the points that he liked or that they like, and then ignore the part where he was talking about the ongoing and raging hypocrisy and suppression in the community. So that's a big part of the problem.
Thank you for that. And I appreciate that, Keith. You are not the first to point that out. You know, Charles, whether it's Jacksonville City Hall or any city that honors the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I think it is fair to say that MLK over the years has evolved into the patron saint of redemption. But white folks in particular have cherry-picked his words, his rhetoric.
Yes.
There are a lot of quotes we could point to that Dr. King said before he was assassinated, that some of the folks honoring him on Monday not only would not agree with, but would be actively upset about. They would consider them to be quite radical, particularly what he had to say about economic and social justice for poor people in this country, going beyond his work to dismantle segregation. But what he had to say about systems of oppression that keep people poor mm-hmm. and powerless. What about that?
Yeah, and without, you know, trying to speak too much for the NAACP, and just going by what my conversation was with Mr. Rumlin last week, these are the things that they are pursuing to maintain as a part of their event. The more accurate tone for civil rights, to be able to communicate to the community to those things that Dr. King stood for, and not just the legacy we sort of celebrate now, where, you know, the one portion of the I Have a Dream speech where, you know, not just by the content of the, you know, color your skin, but by the content of the character. A lot came before that. A lot, there was a lot of not only rhetoric, but movement and policy change that went before that, that sort of, you know, brought us to the point where we are now. And because the civil rights organizations believe that that needs to be infused, continue to be infused in the messaging that belongs to this event, I think that's probably where the two sides were not able to come together. And in doing so, you miss out on the entire message for the entire community for any issue related to Jacksonville.
And that's where the division came from, right? The city didn't want, isn't down with hearing the or putting on stage the entire
that
message.
That is the perception.
Or that's the perception
from
anyway.
From NAACP's perspective.
Okay, let's take one more call. It's Scott on the north side. Go ahead, Scott.
Yes, you are quoting some information that's incorrect. The reason why it's a separation of the cause of Isaiah Rumlin, ignorance. And what I mean by that, he wanted to control the money. It was about money more than us being divided, even though we have been divided in this city since consolidation. And we have not addressed the issues in this community. We have other issues here in this community that we are not addressing when it comes to civic and social engagement. That's one biggest problem with this city here. It's just not the MLK. This city is separated overall, but when it comes to the African-American community, I do not trust Isaiah Rumlin and the SCLC. Both are defunct civil rights organizations. And as I know Charles here, who's on the call here, it's disrespectful to MLK the way Isaiah Rumlin and the SCLC is representing our community, and I'm appalled. Thank you.
Okay, what about that?
Well, you know, certainly Mr. Scott is, you know, is due to his opinion, and his voice is, you know, he is always voicing his opinion, and we respect that. Mr. Rumlin did not communicate anything to me related to money. It was funding or control of money. His thoughts were all central on related to the difference of opinion on how they should proceed from an organizational standpoint. If there's anything like that going on, I wouldn't know about it. It didn't explain it to me.
All right. With all of that said, here's another tweet from Tony. He says, we always have a third event during Black History Month, remembering local heroes. Organizers and the community at both of the MLK breakfasts should be active in all events for civil rights. Go learn more. Black history in Jacksonville is inspiring. Thanks for that. And so, two breakfasts on Friday and the big parade on Monday, Charles.
Yes, plenty of events, plenty of activities. And I think the big picture is that what we hope is that the entire community will do something to celebrate. I know that my friends, we kind of joke about this, but we always consider MLK a day on, not a day off. That means to do yeah. something to help support
something
the community.
Of service. That's really
service,
taken
yes.
hold in recent years.
Yes,
yeah.
Yeah. And really, it's really sort of to honor the legacy of giving and understanding for the entire community and not just the Black community.
Charles Griggs, always good to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, master guitarist Jesse Cook, a preview of his concert next week right here on our own WJCT soundstage. Plus, it's a new model of healthcare without insurance.
There's too many of you cry. Brother, brother, brother. There's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way.
time can feel slow.
An hour takes forever when you're five.
Time can feel fast.
There's a lot you can capture with just a second.
Time is always changing.
You're seeing the past, you're in the present, you're thinking about the future. It's all there. It focuses us on life.
I'm Guy Raz, shifting time on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday at 11 a.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
For 25 years, WJCT's radio reading service has been providing daily readings of your local paper, the Florida Times-Union. Perhaps you have blindness or need help reading the paper. You can listen to it being read online at wjct.org/radio reading. Or we'll send you a radio tuned to radio reading service. It's free because radio reading gives voice to the printed word. Call 904-358-6308.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m., only on 89.9 FM, WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, award-winning master guitarist Jesse Cook will be performing right here at the WJCT Soundstage next Tuesday night. This concert is in partnership with the Florida Theater, and it's going to be a great event. I recently spoke with him about the show and his music. Let's listen. Jesse Cook, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It is a pleasure for me.
We are so excited that you'll be performing at our own WJCT Soundstage in partnership with the Florida Theater on the 21st. Tell us a little bit more about your new studio album, Beyond Borders, because you draw inspiration from music all around the world. It's a truly wondrous sound that you and your musicians create on stage.
Thank you. Yeah, Beyond Borders was... I was part of two albums that I did around the same period. The first one was called One World, and the second one was called Beyond Borders. And I sort of think of them as being kind of part of a same statement, you know, which is, I've been playing guitar a long time, and I've been making music, you know, collaborating with different musicians from around the world a long time. And I slowly began to realize that old saying that music is the universal language was actually true. You know, there have just been too many times when I found myself in some place, some part of the world where I didn't speak the language. For example, I was in China one time, and I'm in Beijing. I'm backstage at some old theater, and the promoter comes to me, and they said, how would you feel about performing with some Tibetan musicians? And I said, yes, would love to. You know, I love that kind of thing, just right up my alley, you know. So we're backstage, we get introduced, me and a bunch of musicians from Tibet, and immediately we realized we can't say a word to each other. You know, we didn't even know how to say hi in each other's language. It was ridiculous. I mean, if you're in France or Italy or something, you know some word, and I realized that there's nothing.
Wow.
One word we have in common. I thought, how are we going to do this? And sure enough, we pull out our instruments, and we start playing, and we realized, in fact, we totally have a common language, which is music. And we went on stage that night and performed a piece of music together, and it was kind of amazing, you know. And I sort of feel like we live in a time now where we're just constantly talking about things that, you know, are divisions, things that divide us. You know, we're not like them and they're not like us, and it just, you know, I sort of feel like if music can come together so beautifully, maybe music has something to teach us.
Right.
And that's kind of what these albums are about.
It's such a cliche to call it the universal language, but it really is. And, of course, people saw you on our airwaves in December when we aired your special on TV, Jesse Cook, Beyond Borders. And you had a lifetime going beyond borders, didn't you? Didn't that kind of inform your international flair with music, because you lived in several different places as a child?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I my parents were Canadian, but they had done that thing where they kind of moved to Europe. I think my dad wanted to be Hemingway, basically. He wanted to
move to Paris and live on the Left Bank and write his great novel. And it didn't really work out for him, but he ended up sort of becoming a photographer to just to pay the bills. And he did quite well doing fashion photography. And my mom went to London as a journalist, and she ended up in Paris with my dad. And yeah, we moved around a fair amount. I think we lived in Barcelona for about 6 months when I was two. I don't really remember much of that. My mom claims that, you know, oh, it was very important because you had this little toy guitar and you used to wander around the apartment singing "Want Tanto Meta." But I really have no recollection of those things. But what did happen is when we sort of came back to Canada, I arrived in Toronto, which is this city that is, you know, very multicultural. It's a huge immigrant population, and to the point where there is no one group that is in the majority. And, you know, people of British descent, I think, are the largest group, and they're something like 6% of the population. So it was this thing where, you know, I already loved music from Europe. I loved that sort of flamenco guitar sound that I'd sort of got hooked on. And then I moved to Canada, and I'm introduced to all these other sounds, and it just became this thing that for me, that's what music was. It's kind of big stew.
It's a great sound, and we are really looking forward to hosting you as you play our WJCT Soundstage on the 21st. This is in partnership with Florida Theater on the Road. So, Jesse Cook, a pleasure. Have a great show, a part of your tour, and we'll be seeing you very soon. Thanks so much.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to it.
Get your tickets for Jesse Cook. Just go to wjct.org/events. Well, a local physician is leading the way in benchmarking a new insurance and healthcare model for the First Coast. It's called direct primary care. Patients have one physician and they have 24/7 access to them. They're able to pay for medications and labs at a wholesale rate because they pay with cash. Yeah, you remove the insurance equation. The idea is to save patients money and also for doctors to move away from control by hospital systems and the insurance giants. So how does this work? Well, we're very curious, and we're pleased to welcome Dr. Tanya Reimschissel of Arise Direct Primary Care. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
And it's 549-2937. What are your questions about direct primary care? So what is this model? How does it work?
So what it is it started probably about 15 years ago by a physician who was just kind of fed up with the overall insurance industry. And it's a model of care that omits the middleman, or you don't have to have insurance. You simply pay by cash. Mm-hmm. And it's an affordable solution, and you have a monthly fee, and the person gets direct access to the physician and can set up an appointments within 24 to say, like, same day appointments or 24 hours. There's no insurance used for it, and the cost is typically per month anywhere from, say, like $50 typically to $100 depending on the age of the patient that you see. So what this does is it allows a physician to control their own practice as opposed to bigger corporations or hospitals kind of dictating to them the amount of patients mm-hmm. that they're going to be seeing, when they're going to be seen. And it allows that doctor to schedule their own patients, see them as long as they need to in order to get like a comprehensive idea of what's all going on with them.
So the patient gets more time and access to the doctor.
Exactly.
And so say I were your patient and I paid a monthly fee of mm-hmm. $50 to $100 a month, that would cover right. all my visits to you for primary care?
It would cover it for a month. So it let's say it's $100 per month, then it'd be $1,200 per year. So the $100 per month enables you to see me, have access to me for that whole month, 24 hours a day, basically. And you can either be seen in the office or like we have telehealth, or you can text me, you can email me. So you don't have to hopefully go to urgent care or an emergency room. You can, you know, have that access right away if needed.
So you have nearly 10 years as an internist. What types of patients are you typically seeing, and how are they reacting to this model?
Well, usually an internist, it's adult medicine, and you see patients anywhere from 18 on up. The type of patients that we could see would be anything from a simple illness, or, you know, somebody that needs sutures, it has lacerations, sprained bones, broken bones, and then also more complex issues such as like cardiovascular issues like hypertension, people that have had heart attacks, people with diabetes, osteoporosis, thyroid disorders. It kind of runs the gamut. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of different types of patients and variety of patients that you'll see.
How do you make money at it? Are you getting paid the same that you would if you went the traditional route?
So myself am just currently starting at it. I've been doing it for a couple months now, and I'm slowly building my business. But typically the doctors that have started this are either making as much as what they were making when they were employed by, say, another corporation or hospital, or they can actually sometimes find that they're even making more money. And at the same time, for the patient, it's more affordable. And so it's kind of like a win-win situation for both the patient and the doctor.
The direct primary care model, if you're just tuning in, is giving family doctors a new alternative to the fee-for-service insurance billing system. Instead, they charge patients a monthly fee, a reasonable one. And as frustrated as all of us are with the healthcare system and what we pay to insurance companies, it turns out the doctors are just as frustrated too, which is why more of them are doing what you're doing, right, doctor?
Exactly. Yeah, I got really frustrated because, you know, medicine and that, it's all fine. It's a business, and you need to make money in order to keep functioning. But it started where to make money, you have to see so many patients. And this type of medicine, I can still do well and be in charge. And if I need to see my patients for 20 minutes to an hour, I can. And I don't have to see them in like 15 minutes so I can get through the rest of my 20
Which
to 25
is so
patients
awful
per day.
For the patients and you, yeah. 549-2937. How do you see this model evolving as the nation continues to grapple with healthcare reform and healthcare costs?
Well, right now it's a growing trend, and more physicians are turning to it because there's a high rate of burnout in primary care physicians, internal medicine physicians, family physicians. And so we're looking for an alternative because doctors, they want to provide good comprehensive care to their patients. And it's very frustrating when you're on a time schedule and you cannot always do that. And in fact, because you can't spend as much time with them, the malpractice insurance with direct primary care for a physician has actually gone down if you do direct primary care, because you're actually making less errors because you know the patient better.
Okay, so it's Arise Direct Primary Care is the name of your business. The website is arisedirectprimary.com. And as you said, you're just starting out with this. Mm-hmm. Are you the first physician in Jacksonville to set this up?
No, I'm not. To my knowledge, in fact, we've kind of become friends. There's another physician that is down closer to the beach that does this, and we've actually met each other and kind of have been helping one another through this. I think there might be a few more, but I'm just not aware of them right now.
But it sounds as though it's a lot more rewarding for you.
It is.
As a physician.
Exactly. Because I, again, like to treat the whole patient. I believe in nutrition. I believe in physical activity. I believe in prevention. And this is a way to get patient on a track to health as opposed to always treating a disease. It's taking it a step further.
Let's get one more call in. It's Jackie in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Jackie. We're coming up to a break, so go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Well, good morning. Yeah, I was interested to find out in this kind of concierge model, how does that work if a patient needs lab work or they need to go have a procedure done? How is that covered?
Sure. Thank you for that question. Doctor.
Okay. So if they need to be referred to a specialist, I can go ahead and do that. Some specialists are actually trying to get into this type of model too. One of the really neat benefits of this is I can order labs, I can order prescription medicines and dispense them in my office, and they are all at wholesale prices. And just to give you an example, like a complete blood count, a count we call complete metabolic count, a thyroid studies, a lipid panel, a urinalysis, could be hundreds of dollars with insurance. If I order it for that patient, it comes out to a little over $24.
I'll take that. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of patients will too.
Right,
so
right.
Check it out. It's Arise Direct Primary Care. Find them online at arisedirectprimary.com. She's Dr. Tanya Reim-Schissel, and it's an interesting new model. We'll follow it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And up next, artist Jason Tetlack, why he wants to paint a huge mural of Bill Murray in, where else? Murray Hill. That's next.
At Coker Law, when it comes to your health, there's no room for medical mistakes. You rely on your doctors to make informed decisions about your care. Unexpected shouldn't mean unaccountable. Coker Law is dedicated to getting you answers. CokerLaw.com. Jacksonville Country Day School. Through intellectual exploration involving project-based and transformative learning, JCDS prepares pre-K 3 through 6th grade students for success at the next academic level and beyond. More at jcds.com. Open house January 16th.
Apartment buildings are getting taller these days, in part because people are looking for shops and gyms in the building.
We're definitely seeing in markets like Denver and Houston and Nashville, places where people normally would have expected to have a little more space and spread out, but people are really demanding these neighborhood amenities.
I'm Kai Rizdal. The growth of high-rises next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Robin Young. As we take stock of the state of spirituality, we're going to look at the internet and a site, for instance, that helps people through traumas.
Believe it or not, the ones who had the most positive outcome were not those who were receiving help, but the ones who were giving help to others.
Also, the latest on the impeachment of President Trump, next time here and now.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
The world's largest technology company is once again clashing with the federal government.
We have asked Apple for their help in unlocking the shooter's phones. So far, Apple has not given any substantive assistance.
Can we keep the nation safe without giving the state the key to our encrypted lives? I'm Todd Zwillick. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. You can see that gopher right now, can't you? Jacksonville-based artist Jason Tetlack can too. He's the founder of the Murray Hill Mural Project. Jason just launched a Kickstarter campaign to raise funds for a new iconic mural that will feature Bill Murray and will welcome residents into the Murray Hill neighborhood. What could be more fun than that? Jason Tetlack, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you're known for your mural projects over in Murray Hill. What prompted this new one?
Well, there's a new wall that's been exposed right at the entryway to Murray Hill. There was a developer who tore down a building and kind of exposed this big, ugly, gray concrete block wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first thing you see when you come into Murray Hill. And I said, we can't have that. We need something colorful and bright there. And so I just kind of went with it.
None other than Bill Murray's mug is going to go there if you get your way.
Why not?
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun. Now, as you're coming from Riverside into Murray Hill, you cross the railroad tracks on Roosevelt and you come into the Little Murray Hill Town Center. The mural will be on the right just as you enter the neighborhood, right?
Correct.
That's
yes.
Where you want to put it.
That's right.
Okay. So you have a Kickstarter campaign up right now. You're about halfway to your goal?
That's correct. Yeah. Last time I was here, I think we talked about the art show where I was burning my art to sort of force people to confront their relationship with art. And I see this kind of as an extension. It's kind of like, if you don't fund this project, I'm not going to paint it. So I'm kind of putting it on the residents to sort of, you know, contribute and make it happen.
So go to Kickstarter right now if you're a Bill Murray fan and you'd like to see this Murray Hill mural project feature his face. So any other incentives for people to donate?
Yeah. So as part of the project, if you donate certain dollar amounts, you get little rewards. So, I've come up with stickers and prints and things like that people can get for donating certain amounts. I've even come up with some experiences. If you've ever, dreamt of being an artist or wondered how it works to paint a mural, certain dollar amounts, you can come out and help me paint sections of the mural and, fun stuff like that.
I'm looking at the Kickstarter page right now. Go to Kickstarter and just search New Murray Hill Mural. Jason's raised about half of what he needs, and I'm looking at the image you want to create. It's a pretty cool, colorful visual that we have here of the neighborhood, Murray Hill, and smack dab in the middle, a kind of pensive-looking Bill Murray. You know, Bill Murray spends time in this area. I don't know. He might hear about this. Maybe you can even get him to make an appearance, do some photo bombing when you unveil this. He's kind of known for that.
Yeah, from what I've heard, Bill's the kind of guy who just shows up at things when he feels like it. I've had people suggest, like, what if we tried to get Bill Murray to come? And I don't think that's really how it works with Bill.
Yeah, you never can tell. He's
right.
A little unpredictable that way.
Yeah.
But so what's the reaction been amongst your fellow, I should say, Murray Hillites to this?
Bill's face has already sort of been adapted by some people with little bumper stickers and things like that. So when people saw this design, a lot of people got really excited, and it's very colorful. It's much different than what we've seen in the area before. So people are very excited to see something like this happen.
Do you think he's a good icon for the neighborhood? His whole persona?
His reputation is kind of like hipster and cool and low key. And I think that sort of represents Murray Hill pretty well. When you think about Riverside, Avondale and Murray Hill, we're sort of more of the cool hipster hangout place. And I think he fits very well with that.
Now, there's a chance this mural could be painted and then actually obscured if a developer builds next to it. What about that?
Yeah, that's correct. The property owner of the lot next door could potentially put in retail space that would cover the mural at some point. In my opinion, street art is sort of impermanent by nature anyway. Mm-hmm. And more important to me is that this gray wall is sort of the first thing people see when they come in the neighborhood. And I don't want to leave that indefinitely sitting there just in case something else goes in further down the road.
As an artist, you just can't stand looking at that empty wall, can you?
I see empty walls all over town that I want to paint.
You just can't. You just got to get in there and paint them. So if you agree and you'd like to see Bill Murray greeting you as you drive into Murray Hill, go to Kickstarter and contribute to Jason Tetlack's project, The New Murray Hill Mural. By the way, do we even know who the original Murray was that Murray Hill was named after?
No, there's some rumor that it was named after Murray Hill in New York when developers came down.
Oh, okay.
But no one knows for sure.
We need to find that out, don't we? I'm going to get on that later. Jason Tetlack, good luck. I know it'll be gorgeous and fun to look at and vibrant when it's all done. So check it out on Kickstarter. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. Jessica Palumbo is station news director, and Bill Bortzfeld is station digital editor. We want your comments. Meanwhile, send them always feedback to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from this morning's program, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. We'll be back again tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our Friday Media Roundtable. Let's connect then. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.